Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, and let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Vance. We are anticipating the others coming soon. I'd like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Kelsey from the Juno LAO. Thank you so much. On today's agenda, we will be hearing two bills. The committee is going to continue the conversation about House Bill 66 on controlled substances from the governor and presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its second hearing. The committee will then have a first hearing on HB 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records by Representative Wright. And it is my intention to hear that in the second hour. We will now take up House Bill 66, Control Substance. So I'd like to welcome to the table Department of Law Criminal Division Director, Mr. John Skidmore. And I'd also let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Carpenter. Please state your name for the record and continue your presentation on House Bill 66.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the Alaska Department of Law. And the document that was handed out to you all, prior to today's hearing and that we have up on the screen here, was a document that we had been requested to create that tries to provide a broad, big picture overview of the statutes and criminal statutes involving controlled substances in the state. I want to make a couple of introductory comments to that particular document. It is an attempt to summarize things. It is not meant to be an exhaustive, this answers everything that's there. This does not include all the definitions. This does not include every subsection of misconduct involving controlled substances. It's trying to give a big, broad overview. If there are questions about specifics, I encourage people to refer to the statutes. We've tried to place those on the document as well to orient folks to the statutes that they need to look to. As always, I like to remind people any summary document that the Department of Law provides is not in and of itself a legal document. It is a summary of the laws, and if there are questions about what the laws say, I always encourage people to go back to the laws themselves. That is the true authority and determination of such things.
Thank you. I'd like to let the record reflect we were joined by Representative Eastman at 102.
If I can just orient you all to the chart itself, there are two different pages. I'm going to actually flip to the other page of the chart here. And this is the one that says drug classifications at the top. This lays out the Alaska scheduling of controlled substances. At our hearing on Monday, we, of course, understood that there are other states that also set schedules, as well as the federal government. And what the federal government does is not always consistent with what we do. One example that we had highlighted for us on that, of course, was fentanyl. The other example I would highlight for you all is marijuana. We schedule it as a Schedule 6, and the federal government schedules it as a Schedule 1. So there are differences. There can be differences. And when we talk about the criminal law, which is really what this bill is talking about and where my expertise is, we're going to be talking about the state scheduling of those controlled substances, not the federal schedules. But what this does is it lays out for you, a very short synopsis to give you a sense of what is in the schedules. The schedules themselves take up a number of pages and have a very long listing of drugs in each schedule. This is an attempt to give you a sense of what is in each schedule. So, for example, you have Schedule 1A, which is synthetic and non-synthetic opioids. We list a couple of examples, heroin, oxycodone, fentanyl. These are all examples of what is there. It is not an exhaustive list of all of the substances that fall into those categories. Also within Schedule 1 is gamma hydroxo, I'm not going to pronounce that correctly. I call it GHB. It is otherwise known as a drug that's commonly used in date rape situations. It is also included in Schedule 1 for Alaska statutes. Schedule 2 is then listed below it. That's where you have your psychedelics and hallucinogens, by and large, things like peyote, what are commonly referred to as magic mushrooms. or PCP, ecstasy or Molly, which is the street name for it. The more technical name is MDMA. Also within that schedule are some stimulants, such as methamphetamines, amphetamines like Adderall, barbiturates, and then cocaine. Again, these are not exhaustive. They're just trying to give you a sampling of what is within them. Schedule 3A is some other stimulants like appetite suppressants, depressants, sedatives, hypnotics, and certain anesthetics. Those are all found in Schedule 3A, 4A, benzodiazepines, and ketamine are some of the examples of the things that are there. There are some more specific examples that are listed. Schedule 5A, you then see the ones that are listed there. And then finally 6A, which is marijuana. Again, particularly when it comes to the schedules, I do not begin to have these memorized. There is such a long listing of them. If you have a question about a particular substance, I encourage either members of the committee or the public to go to the statutes themselves to see what's actually listed there. Before I go to the other page, are there any questions for me about any of these tiers or the scheduling that's there?
I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, not seeing any hands, I'm going to go back to the other page that we had provided for you all. I think. There we go. And this is the controlled substance reference chart. This is a chart that is meant to give, again, a summary of how the controlled substances, misconduct involving controlled substances are tiered. Misconduct involving controlled substance, also often referred to by the initials MICS or MIX, those charges are broken down into degrees, and the basic elements, you're looking at sort of three common factors: whether or not the substance is possessed or controlled with the intent to deliver, manufactured, or delivered itself, whether or not it is merely possessed, and then whether or not it is possessed or delivered with some other factor contributing to it, for example, whether or not it's distributed to individuals under a certain age, or if it's possessed near a school district or a youth center, something of that sort. Again, all of those details are not found on this summary. We were trying to focus in simply on the distribution of the drugs and not the possession of them, because the bill that we were dealing with is dealing with distribution, so that's what we had focused on. So you're not going to find every subsection on the summary. It's just meant to give you a broad picture. In Alaska, you have felonies divided into four categories: unclassified, Class A, Class B, and Class C. You see those listed in the second column for the class and range. The class is referring to what I just said, the class of felony. And then the range is really referring to the sentences that would typically be imposed. And so what you have is the range for a misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first. It's an unclassified felony. It has a minimum of 5, a maximum of 99. Where within that a particular sentence falls is really up to the courts. You have a Class A felony where you have a presumptive sentence of 4 to 7, but a maximum of 20. And that presumptive, if you'll note down in footnote number 2, is dealing with a first-time felony offender. If they have a previous felony conviction, there is a calculus that we use to determine, is that what we consider a qualifying felony offense that increases the presumptive range? I'm not going to go into all those details today. I just want you to understand, with prior convictions of a felony nature, we sometimes evaluate, is there a higher presumptive that applies? And so you can see that for the unclassified, it's 5 to 99. For the Class A, the presumptive is 4 to 7 with a maximum of 20. For a Class B, the presumptive is 1 to 3, a maximum of 10. A Class C is 0 to 2 with a maximum of 5. And then the last category is Class A misdemeanors, misdemeanors and felonies. You'll recall the difference between them. A misdemeanor is something for which you would potentially be subject to jail of 1 year or less, and a felony is anything for which you can be subject to jail of more than 1 year. On the far right-hand side, you have the conduct that is included. So if we go back up to the top, from misconduct involving controlled substances in the first degree, you can see that it's the delivers a Schedule 1, 2, or 3A controlled substance, And here's where we get that nuance that I described a few moments ago to someone under the age of 19 years of age, and there's more than a three-year age difference. If someone is delivering one of those scheduled substances to someone under the age of 19, that makes it the unclassified felony. There is also something called engaging in a continued felony drug dealing enterprise. That continuing criminal enterprise is defined within the statute itself. It requires a series of transactions of five or more. It requires the person to be involved with five or more people, and it requires a significant portion of income to be derived from it. This is designed to go after those individuals that are drug dealers and get a substantial portion of their income from the distribution of drugs.
Can I ask you about the specific age of 19?
Yes.
And if you recall why that particular age was chosen, I'm always trying to understand the variations in our statute, because 18 is considered as an adult. We have different ages of consent and things like that. Why the age of 19?
To the chair, you're asking an excellent question. Unfortunately, you are beyond my memory of why they chose the age of 19. We would have to go back and do legislative history to determine, is there any legislative history of why they chose 19 at the time that they did. You are correct that the statutes throughout will use different ages. Those are different policy decisions that the legislature has made. I don't have a specific knowledge of why 19 was chosen.
I think that's worthy of looking at, being as, you know, alcohol 21. Like, there, the lack of consistency in our statutes, because, you know, we piecemeal with what's before us in the legislature most of the time. But from the public's perspective, I don't think we're doing them a benefit when we're inconsistent. So I think that would be worthy of us looking into that, just for the broader view of these classifications, especially when it comes to these drugs. Do we have any further questions before he continues from members? Okay, Representative Groh.
Thank you. And with the chair's permission, I'd like to go back to this earlier. The graphic which has the Medicaid or the substances listed.
Sure.
There's 1A through 6A. Are there Bs or Cs? I mean, are we only have As? And I understand what you said, that there's not a comprehensive listing here, but
through the chair, Representative Groh, the schedule refers to it as a Schedule 1A. It does not list additional subsections of a B, C, or anything of that nature. I don't know why they call it 1A. That's the way it's always referred to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think this is the game that we had to figure out a way to stump you, because you really impressed us with your references last time. So we had to figure out something that you didn't know in the statute.
You are definitely beyond my knowledge in that case, and I apologize. If we go back to the chart itself, I've returned to the controlled substances reference chart. We go to the misconduct involving controlled substance in the second degree. This one talks about the manufacture or delivery of a Schedule 1A controlled substance. That is a Class A felony. 1A in Alaska statutes is considered the most dangerous. Again, this is a determination made by the state of Alaska for the scheduling of those. I did have a question the other day about delivery. I tried to find the definition and I failed quickly. There is a definition for delivery in the statutes, just for reference. It is found in Alaska Statute 1171-900, subsection A7 is the definition of delivery. And my common law definition that I provided you the other day is consistent with what the statutory one says. So there was no inaccuracy in that, but I did want to point out where you can find that definition. The second part then of misconduct involving controlled substance in the second degree talks about the manufacture or the intent to manufacture methamphetamine. This is a series of subsections within this statute that deals with the way in which methamphetamine is made. It is based upon the concerns that the making of methamphetamine is extremely dangerous and can cause significant harm to others if they're in the presence of someone attempting to make methamphetamine, and the risks of explosions that are associated with the way in which it's attempted to be made. And so there's a whole series of subsections that address individuals attempting to make methamphetamine, and all of that is found in this higher classification of the Class A felony. I then will move down to the next one, which is the Class B felony. The Class B felony in that circumstance is misconduct involving controlled substance in the third degree, and that one is a B felony. We've already gone over the sentences. The conduct that is involved for that one deals with the delivery of Schedule 4, 5, and 6A substances to someone under the age of 19. Of course, we know that marijuana is by and large legal for people to possess and deliver so long as they do it within the regulations adopted by the state. But those laws say that if you're under the age of, I think it's 19 or 21, I forget, I have to go back and double check that, you're not supposed to be possessing. And here you can see that the delivery to somebody under the age of 19 still falls within this felony offense because that is not otherwise legalized in our statutes. There's also required to be that three-year age difference. Beyond that, really what the misconduct involving controlled substance in the third degree addresses is the manufacturer or deliverer of Schedules 2 and 3A substances to somebody else. That's where that manufacturer or deliverer resides. We then go down to the C felony, which is misconduct involving controlled substances in the fourth degree. This is where you get to the manufacturer or deliverer of 4A or 5A. It is also the possession of 1A. That's possessing without an intent to distribute. So this is really that personal use that you get into in that circumstance. And then you also have the manufacturer delivery of more than an ounce of Schedule 6A without proper permitting. Again, the without proper permitting is describing where you have individuals that attempt to engage in sale or distribution of marijuana outside of the regulations that the state has adopted. So I just want to be clear about what that language is supposed to be covering. And then beyond that, we go down to the misconduct involving controlled substances in the fifth degree. These now become the misdemeanors. This is where you get to the manufacturer deliver of less than 1 ounce of a Schedule 6A controlled substance without proper permitting. Again, that's where we're talking about the marijuana. And then you have the possession of any amount of a Schedule 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, or 5A controlled substance without proper prescription. So that's really what the chart describes overall. Again, I'm going to reiterate this because I want to make sure that everyone's heard loud and clear. These are summaries. This is not an exhaustive listing of what the law says. And if there are any questions about that, I refer people back to the statutes themselves. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions about anything that's on the chart.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I suppose bill does give prosecutors an awful lot of discretion, I guess, more discretion than they currently have. My question is, you had mentioned Adderall, I think. Where does Adderall fall on the schedule?
Adderall is actually, through the chair, Representative Eastman, Adderall is found on the first page that I discussed, and it is a Schedule 2A. It's an amphetamine. And so that's where it resides. And I'm not sure that I would agree with you that the bill provides prosecutors greater discretion. It's the same discretion that we have currently. What it's doing is changing the classification of an offense, but it doesn't give us any more or less discretion than we currently have in terms of how we approach the cases.
Follow up.
So what I mean by that is currently you would not be able to charge an individual for second-degree murder without the bill. And when the bill passes, if it does, you would then have the discretion of being able to charge some of the same conduct as second-degree murder. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it changes whether it is considered a manslaughter or a murder in the second degree. From my perspective, that's not additional discretion. That's simply the classification that it falls in. But our discretion is whether or not we decide to charge something. And this bill doesn't change that in any way, shape, or form.
Follow up. So I'd like to understand what the bill as written would accomplish. And I know that might be different than what you as a prosecutor would choose to do with the bill based on your discretion. So if you have a situation where family members have similar prescriptions, say Adderall, for example, they both have Adderall prescriptions, and you have a parent that chooses to give their Adderall to a child. Well, maybe the child lost their prescription and whatnot, and the parent's saying, hey, I'm gonna bring you your Adderall. Or maybe they try and drop it off to them at school, for example. Is that the type of conduct that we are now saying is going to be caught up in this, since you have an individual delivering a controlled substance that they don't have the prescription to? Deal with the school grounds issue separately, but is that now potentially caught up in this, or is there some exception where that would never happen because we've written into the bill that that couldn't happen?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this bill does not in any way touch on a parent sharing a prescription with a child. If your question for me is that illegal under current law, regardless of what happens with this bill, the answer is yes. That is illegal under current law. If your question for me is what happens with prosecutorial discretion, that's a separate question, in which case, one, the case would have to be reported to us. So you're going to have someone that knows the parent's given the prescription to the child, likely other than the parent or the child. And then we would have to determine that we have sufficient evidence to charge it and that it's appropriate for us to charge it. But all of that is a far separate conversation than what this bill is actually covering.
Follow up.
Thank you. My question is just, does this change the classification for that conduct?
No, it does not.
Thank you.
One of the things, questions that I was asking myself on in moving this classification from manslaughter to second degree murder is, what are the other qualifications of someone being charged with second degree murder? And just walking through that, because previously you discussed the various people, the A, B, C, D in this line of distribution that could be charged. And the bigger question that the committee has is if we feel that it is appropriate that they be charged for second degree murder. And so I was looking at the above on in section one, page one on line nine, the person knowingly engages in conduct that results in the death of another person under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. Does that qualification fit inside the change to the statute on page two, where you're talking about the person knowingly manufactures or delivers and there's a resulting death? Is it presumed that the indifference to the value of human life is within that section, or do we need to add that?
To the chair, I think I understand the question you're asking. There are three other subsections. I want to verify this three. Nope, see, look, I'm wrong. There are five other subsections to murder in the second degree, and those five subsections describe other conduct that qualifies. You've specifically referenced one subsection of murder in the second degree. It's subsection A2, where the person knowingly engages in conduct that results in the death of another under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. That is a phrase that's commonly understood to be a situation in which you might have someone that takes a loaded gun, points it at a tent, and fires through the tent with an extreme indifference to the fact that there might be people in the tent and that you're likely going to kill them. Could you take that same concept and apply it to the idea of the distribution of drugs, knowing the increased use of fentanyl, the unregulated increased use of fentanyl in those street distributions of drugs? Could that be considered an extreme indifference? I suppose we could argue that theory, but by changing the subsection of the statute to place it in murder two, it's clearer that that's what we're saying should be there. And let me take it from a slightly different approach. Having that subsection with that language in manslaughter right now if I was the defense attorney, I would argue if a prosecutor tried to say it amounts to extreme indifference to the value of human life, no, no, there's a specific subsection of manslaughter that covers this conduct that's found in a different statute, and therefore that's what should be applied, not this element of extreme indifference. And the prosecution would have to articulate why the extreme indifference was there's something more in this case than simply the distribution. So in order for the state to be able to get to a murder two, we would need to move the subsection, as the bill proposes, from manslaughter to murder two. Would I argue, absent its presence in manslaughter, that it should amount to extreme indifference? I think I could make that argument as a prosecutor. I don't know if the courts would agree with me. I don't know how the jury would view that. To make it abundantly clear, having a subsection in the statutes gives us all the tools we need and makes it clear what the legislature's intent about how that conduct should be treated. Those are the questions in front of the committee, if that's something that you all want to do.
Representative Eastman. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a series of questions about good time. My understanding is that the Department of Corrections might be online as well to answer some questions. But I was curious about who or what determines good time, good behavior. This first question.
Is that question the chair. For corrections?
For corrections.
We have Michael Matthew here with the Department of Corrections. Please state your name for the record, and if you could answer the question for Representative Gray.
For the record, my name is Mike Matthews. I'm the lead research analyst with Alaska Department of Corrections. I'm sorry, I'll have to get back to you on that. That's a process that occurs within the institutions, so I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
You have a follow-up?
I do. Through the chair, how much of a person's sentence can be reduced by good behavior?
It is, through the chair, it is my understanding that it is one-third.
And follow-up.
What
crimes do not qualify a person for good behavior?
Through the chair, that is in statute, and I'd have to look that up and get back to you on that.
If I may, you can find those other crimes in the bill itself, because you're talking about the good time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's section 2 of the bill, which is pages 2 and 3. The listing actually begins on the top of page 3. Those that are not eligible for good time deductions, a mandatory 99-year prison sentence that's imposed under Alaska Statute 1255-125A, a definite term under...
Sorry, sir, would that be like murders?
I'm going to have to go to 1255-125A to tell you precisely what it says.
Okay.
I think that that probably is what it is, but I want to read the statute so I don't give you incorrect information. Also, a definite term under 1255-125L, a sex felony under 1255-125I, with the additional provisions found in subsections A and B of subsection 3 there, where you have one or more prior sexual felonies, or that the sex offense is an unclassified or a Class A felony. And then subsection 4 also talks about unclassified felonies under 1141, 100, and 1141, 110. That's murder in the first and murder in the second is those two statutory references. If you want me to look at 1255-125 subsection A and subsection L, I'm happy to do that and tell you what those specifically say.
Follow up?
Yes. Would removing good time undermine the Department of Corrections ability to use that tool to get better behavior out of people while they're incarcerated?
Is this question for?
Or to the Department of Corrections, through the chair, sorry, through the correction, to the Department of Corrections.
Once again, this is Mike Matthews with the Alaska Department of Corrections. That would be a difficult question to answer, and I'm sorry to say it, but once again, I have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. I have a follow-up. I'll keep going.
Follow-up, Representative.
Okay. Yes. What percentage of people who use or sell drugs, and this could be for the Yes, Mr. Skidmore. What percentage of people who sell drugs are users themselves or are addicted to drugs?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I'm afraid I don't have statistics on the number that are users themselves. I would anecdotally tell you that we certainly see significant overlap between individuals that use and then distribute to try and help support their own addiction, but that's certainly not everyone, and I'm afraid I don't have any statistics to specifically answer the question.
Follow up. How do we reduce recidivism? I guess for whomever can answer the question, Madam Chair, through the chair, do I need to specify?
Representative Gray, yes. That's a very broad policy question.
Can I narrow it down?
I think a narrowed question might be helpful.
How do we reduce recidivism in people who sell drugs and go to jail, who might be addicts themselves?
I'll try and take a stab at that one, Madam Chair. John Skidmore for the record. Through the chair, Representative Gray, when a sentence is imposed in a criminal case, there are multiple tools or techniques that are authorized in statute to try to address an offender to deal with what we refer to as the Cheney criteria or sentencing criteria. One of those criteria, both in the statutes and in the Constitution, is rehabilitation. And in order to achieve that, the statutes expressly authorize courts to impose, for example, substance abuse treatment. Substance abuse treatment is something that can be received either in custody or out of custody. The degree and all of the limitations on what's available in custody are questions for the Department of Corrections, but there is substance abuse in custody that's available. Beyond that, there can be educational programs. Beyond that, we would attempt to place somebody on probation or parole. And when they are on probation or parole, we would then be monitoring them with certain conditions on how they behave, trying to encourage them to change the way in which they behave, including who they can interact with, limiting their ability to interact with other felons, other people that may have been involved in the case in which they were ultimately convicted of. So there's a number of different tools that we attempt to do that. There are many of those tools that are still available, even if good time is restricted. But I think I understand the point of your question is, if good time is restricted, doesn't that impact our ability to have an influence on that?
Follow up. Do we have evidence to show that longer sentences lead to less crime?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the notion is not necessarily that a longer sentence leads to less crime, though that's certainly possible. The notion is individuals that are distributing or selling poison to citizens in the state that's resulting in their death, what are the other criteria that are appropriately imposed for them? I mentioned Cheney criteria a moment ago. Rehabilitation is but one of them. There are five of them. There are general deterrence, there's specific deterrence, there's community condemnation, and there's isolation. And I would submit to you that when you start to deal with those more egregious offenses, you then start to focus more on isolation as well as community condemnation. And so it's a balancing that the courts have to engage in when a sentence is imposed as to which one of those sentencing factors should be the most prevalent. So it's a far more complicated question. Rehabilitation remains, but it's not the only thing to be considered.
Follow up. It's the last one, ma'am. Sorry. Through the chair.
One more follow up.
Yes. Yeah, so in section 2 of the bill, if we go to bill to page 3, lines 10 through 12, you have for a felony under AS 11.71.010 through 11.71.040, you just said that this would only apply to people who gave poison to people. I will get the quote wrong. Poison to people that results in death. But I believe that actually we would be removing good time from all of these, which doesn't involve giving poison to people resulting in death. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone understands that we're taking good time away from all drug offenders, all people who sell, who give pills to somebody. And so I want to make sure that that's what we're doing here. We're taking good time away from all of them.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, you're correct. When I'm talking about peddling that results in the death, I'm thinking of the earlier provision. You're correct. The good time is assigned to anyone that is distributing drugs. And the rationale for that is that anyone distributing drugs is participating in the larger industry that we see such a substantial increase in overdose deaths. Not every single one of them is causing the death. You're absolutely correct about that. However, everyone that is distributing those drugs in those circumstances has a greater risk of being someone that's going to cause the death. And as you heard me describe the other day, we had, I think it was in 2018, 105 overdose deaths. In 2019, there was 133 overdose deaths. We prosecuted one death in each of those circumstances. That's an awful lot of folks that have distributed drugs that resulted in deaths that we're not able to prosecute because we haven't been able to get that evidence. And what part of this is doing is saying, we know there are others out there distributing drugs that are having significant consequences, and there need to be penalties associated with them, even if we're not able to prosecute them for that murder in the second degree. Because any distribution is causing significant challenges to society at large. So that's really the policy question there. I understand your concerns. I understand that's a policy decision for the legislature to make, but I want it to be clear as to why the good time for all other distributors is part of the bill as well.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the Schedule 4A. So misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first, second, third, or fourth degree applies or addresses Schedules 1A through 4A.
Okay.
Okay. The bill, and I guess this is the question, why does the bill focus on misconduct involving a controlled substance 1 through 4, but only for Schedule 4A?
I want to get to that nuance to make sure that I'm following clearly. You're talking about
your Section 1 analysis, if I may.
Yep.
It says a person is guilty of murder in the second.
Yep.
Where the person violates misconduct involving controlled substance 1 through 4.
Yep.
But only for a Schedule 4A controlled substance where the person dies.
Got it.
Resulting in ingesting a Schedule 4A substance. So it doesn't say that it would apply to. So maybe the statute already does this for the other schedules.
So through the chair, Representative Carpenter, there are two parts to the answer to your question. First, the first statutes that are listed all deal with distribution of the drugs. There is no subsection dealing only with the possession, whereas when you get to 1171.040, you'll see the second bullet on the cheat sheet there, if you will, the chart talks about possessing Schedule 1A. So we want to be clear, the possession's not included within that, though obviously the bill talks about knowingly manufactures or delivers, so that should automatically be excluded. But second, when you get to Schedules 6A or when you get to Schedule 5A, that's simply a policy determination that the substances that fall within a 4A or that fall within a 5A or a 6A were not worthy of this same type of penalization. We, the department, the administration, have not changed a word from moving it from manslaughter to murder in the second degree. This is the way the policy is already created and drafted. So we're not changing any policy decision that was previously made by the legislature about who this should apply to. But you're correct in that it calls out 4 versus 5 expressly, and that's a policy decision that was made previously when the manslaughter provision was adopted.
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess what I'm saying is if it's only applying to consumption of 4A substance, and we talked about this as 4A substance are your benzodiazepines and your ketamines,
yep,
but it isn't your hallucinogens and it isn't your opiates, because those are Schedule 1A and 2A, then if somebody consumes Schedule 1A, if they consume heroin and die, or they consume PCP and die, or even a stimulant and die, then this doesn't apply to them. It only applies to people who have taken Schedule 4A.
No, I'm sorry. Let me correct there. The Alaska – I'm sorry. Let me refer to the bill itself. If we go to page 2 of the bill, line 21 – where the person is knowingly manufactured, delivered a controlled substance in violation of 1171.110 through 030. I'm sorry, I said 110. I should have 010 or 030. that's all of those other subsections. So that's where you're getting your Schedule 1, you're getting your Schedule 2, you're getting your Schedule 3, and then it specifically references Schedule 4 because it's eliminating Schedule 5 being included. So the bill covers 1 through 4, but doesn't go to 5 or 6. Okay.
Representative Johnson, are you?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I want to make sure I went through the bath salts wars where they would change a chemical compound and then all of a sudden it's legal. And I just want to put on the record that specifically fentanyl is not one of those drugs where you can just change a compound and all of a sudden it is legal. So I just want to make sure we're not coming back next year and the year after and the year after saying, well, it's fentanyl 1A and fentanyl B. So I just want to on the record that this will take in the fentanyl and someone's not going to come up with, anyway, can come up with something. But just for the record, make sure we're not dealing with a bath salt situation.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, you are not. Fentanyl is a very specific drug. I think we heard some on Monday. Fentanyl is actually used by doctors around the world for very helpful purposes. When it's used the way it's prescribed by a professional, there's no problems with it. So it has a very definitive chemical composition. However, to address your point about individuals that will change the chemical makeup, because we're talking about synthetic opioids, what's different for us from when we went through the bath salt wars is that we now have the ability in statute for the Attorney General, based on recommendations from a group called the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee, to find out about a new chemical mixture that's been put together, and if that hits the streets, we're able to add that to one of the schedules very quickly, and then that comes to the legislature in the next legislative session for you all to determine whether you think it's appropriately scheduled where the Attorney General has placed it. In other words, at the time of the bath salts, we did not have that ability or that option, and that was one of the fixes that was placed into statute at that time so that the state can more nimbly respond to those changes in chemical compositions. But to your first point, you're correct. Fentanyl is a very definitive chemical composition that's not something that's going to be changed around.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm looking at the way that the statute is currently written on page 3 of the bill. And I'm just curious, right now, the way that the language is constructed in Section 2, the good time behavior deduction, or lack thereof, is tied to the prisoner as opposed to being tied or assigned to the specific sentence that prisoner received. Just looking at the language, it would seem that if you had multiple sentences or a sentence involving multiple crimes, however the appropriate way of describing that is, and you have someone who's been given 40 years for something and 2 years for something else, if the 2 years falls under this new language we're adding, then that prisoner would be ineligible for good time for any of the time that they're supposed to be serving. And I'm just wondering if that was intentional or if that is something else.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the good time is something that an individual earns, so the statute is written to apply to the individual. However, I'm not sure that I agree with your reading of the statute, because the restriction is based upon the sentence imposed on the prisoner for a particular crime. In other words, in your hypothetical, if you have someone convicted both for a misconduct involving a controlled substance for which it is restricted and some other crime, let's say a DUI that's not restricted, they can earn good time for that DUI. They just can't earn the good time for the distribution. But the good time goes to the person, not to the conviction, if I'm making sense.
Follow up. So are we getting that from some other part of the bill or some other part of the statute? Because what I'm reading, it just says the prisoner is not eligible for a good time deduction if the prisoner has been sentenced. And then we've got this new language that we're adding. And of course, it would apply to lots of other things too. But I mean, just grammatically, it would seem to point in that direction, unless there's something else somewhere else that's telling us not to interpret it that way.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, when it comes to good time, I see what you're talking about in the statute. I would defer the question to the Department of Corrections that generally goes through and calculates the good time. I'm not the person who does those things. But I don't think the intent is to limit it so that a person can't get good time as to other offenses. That's why we specifically specify them here.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
So I've got two situations that came to mind as I'm looking through the bill and listening to our conversations in committee previously. And one of them is a situation where you have someone who delivers this controlled substance, and then it ends up in someone else's hands. The person they delivered it to gave it to them. It got stolen. It got lost. You know, what have you. And then the person who then has the substance intentionally tries to commit suicide using the controlled substance. Are we saying in that situation that because the person has delivered that controlled substance and then someone else used it to commit suicide, that now is going to be classified potentially as second-degree murder?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I want to make sure I understand the question. You're saying, are we going to hold the distributor responsible if someone attempts to use the substance distributed in an attempt to commit suicide?
Follow up. What I'm asking is, based on the language that we're getting ready to pass, is that now something that the prosecutor can charge as second-degree murder because there was somebody that died? And I don't see anywhere in the language here that's saying whether or not that person wanted to die or didn't want to die. I just don't see that distinction here. So I'm just asking if there's something else that gives us that distinction that I'm missing.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't see anything that distinguishes when someone's attempting to commit suicide. I read what you're reading, which is it's resulted in someone's death. You are holding responsible the person that has distributed the substance that's capable of causing that. The scenario that you describe of someone saying, I'm going to intentionally do this to myself with this substance, I'm struggling to think of the evidence that I would have that tells me they know that that's going to be the outcome. But on the other hand, as a prosecutor, I'm also thinking, well, if the drug dealer has given them the ability to do this, then the statute allows us to hold the drug dealer responsible. Yes.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
The other scenario that comes to mind is when someone delivers that controlled substance,
mm-hmm.
and then somewhere further down the chain, someone adds something to that substance, fentanyl, for example, or maybe, you know, something else, which then, you know, is going to result in further harm or death to somebody at the end of that chain. The individual who gave just the ecstasy minus the fentanyl or pick your, you know, poison,
mm-hmm.
but something that would not have resulted in death, and then someone else later on add something to it, just by looking at the language, it would seem to me that we're not making a distinguish between, you know, we're not distinguishing between the drug dealer who gives the ecstasy, which then, you know, is going to result in someone's death after something's added to it versus not.
You're asking about when a substance is altered between the distribution and the ingestion.
Yes.
It's an interesting question. I would have to think more about whether or not that has altered the substance or not. I don't know immediately off the top of my head how we would analyze that. I need to think through that more.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. I believe this will be a question for Department of Corrections. How much does it cost per day to keep someone incarcerated?
Once again, this is Mike Matthews with Alaska Department of Corrections. Through the chair, we currently charge $176 a day.
Did you say
$176? Yes.
Follow up.
So there's definitely... through the chair, there's a cost per day to keep someone incarcerated. I'm curious about the increased cost based on the amount of time that the person is incarcerated. If we're extending sentences, there should be a cost. We talked about it on Monday. My question is, why is the fiscal note zero? And maybe I can just be educated about that. Thank you.
Through the chair, that's an excellent question. The reason it's a zero fiscal note is because we currently have a capacity of about 750 beds that are available to us. This bill, looking at it singularly, and not assuming there's any other bills that would affect our population, but looking at this bill singularly, we estimate that at best this would probably increase our prison population by about 38, 39 people per day.
Follow up. So that $176 per day times 39, but because we have these extra beds, we don't pay the $176 a day. I'm just curious if we have 750 beds, we can put 750 prisoners there with no charge. Is that what I'm hearing? Is that correct?
Through the chair, generally speaking, that would be correct. We would not ask for any additional money unless we exceeded our maximum capacity.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. So through the chair, so although we say $176 per day, as long as we have beds, it's free.
Through the chair, yes and no. When we say it's $176 a day, I want to be clear here. We, for example, have people that we hold for the federal government, U.S. Marshals, ICE, various federal agencies. We then charge these federal agencies an amount every day for holding them as a courtesy. That amount is $176. So that's where we get the $176 daily bed rate.
Got it. So we charge the federal government $176 a day to hold their prisoners, but our prisoners from the state would be held free of charge.
Through the chair, it's a mathematical formula. It's based on how many people we have per day and how much the costs are for that over the given period of time. So, in a sense, yes, it is free in that context, but of course there are, you know, costs with any time you have additional people. But we are budgeted for a certain amount of people, and right now our budget is under that many people.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair. So I think for me, as this isn't my specialty, I don't understand it very well, but to me, if we were feeding additional people in the Department of Corrections, I believe, and I guess I will be educated later, that it would cost money that would require a fiscal note if we were going to add prisoners to our prison. I mean, is that wrong?
Through the chair, could you repeat the question?
It's not really a question, sir. Thank you. I just don't understand how we can have additional people in our Department of Corrections and have that not be a zero fiscal note. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Okay, hold on. I want to make sure I phrase this right. So is it sort of like a school bus, that if you have 10 students on the bus still has to get to the school even if you have 20 students on the bus? Or if you have the lights on at the school and there's nobody in the building, but the lights stay on, it's the same as if you had students in the school with the lights on?
Mr. Matthew?
Through the chair, thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude like that. Please.
Through the chair, that's a pretty good analogy. We still have you know, the same amount of officers on duty. We would still have the same amount of nurses on duty. So that wouldn't change. I think that's a pretty good analogy.
Madam Chair, may I follow up? And this is another good analogy. So if I buy a loaf of bread for my family of four, the loaf of bread's going to either feed two or four. It feeds us all, regardless of who eats it, correct?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Matthew or Matthews from Department of Corrections?
Yes.
Okay. Sir, I just did a little multiplication. I want to make sure I got it right. $176 a day times 365 days. That's over $64,000. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. I just thought that was interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Department of Corrections, is your budget based upon your capacity or based upon the number of people that are incarcerated?
Through the chair, I want to make sure I get this correct. It's kind of a combination of both. We base what we're estimating now on what occurred last year. So that would be how much we were budgeted and how many people we had serving for how many days.
Follow up.
That's good.
All right. We are at our second hour mark, and we will have this bill before us again on Friday, and also take up public testimony on this bill on Friday, March 3rd at 1 p.m. This is a reminder that the amendment deadline is due to my office tomorrow by 5 p.m. You could get those to me through the judiciary email. That would be helpful. So we are going to take a brief at ease to hear the presentation on House Bill 28. Back on record, I'd like to welcome Representative Wright to the table and his staff to hear House Bill 28. If you could state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Vance. Through the chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I am Representative Stanley Wright of District 22, and I'd like to thank you for hearing House Bill 28. House Bill 28 is an important and necessary step to opening up the opportunities and reducing the barriers for individuals who are convicted of low-level cannabis possession. The Alaska court system has, in fact, already begun on their own to take action that mirrors the support of this bill, and it remedies, all the remedies of the bill as well. With the passage of HB 23, it will codify in statute and protect the ruling of the Alaska court system, along with addressing other aspects of the problems faced by those affected by those convictions. So thank you for this opportunity to present House Bill 28 today. I will now defer to my legislative aide, Mr. Pi Ridden Randall, to explain in further detail about the bill.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Pi Ridden Randall, legislative aide to Representative Stanley Wright of District 22. I would like to thank the chair and the members of the committee today for hearing this bill. House Bill 28 recognizes that there are still convictions on the books which contradict Alaska's current statutes. These convictions can be burdensome on individuals as they are classified. The classification can be easy to confuse with other convictions of a harsher sentence and can result in an inaccurate assessment of one's criminal history or background. These convictions put many Alaskans at risk of excess obstructions when seeking employment or housing. And this bill does contain provisions for certain organizations and agencies to access these records in whole or in part under listed circumstances within the bill. In regard to the bill, as representative stated, it has been supported by the court through their own action of their amendment to the administrative rule which I do have the added wording attached here and available, the entire ruling, if anybody does want to review that. I believe it was forwarded ahead of time, but if that is needed, I'd be happy to provide that. I would like to, at this point, though, defer to some invited testimony.
Madam Chair, if I may, I know I'm going a little bit off script on this one, but I just wanted to say something. I think right now a bill like this gives folks an opportunity to reach their full potential. Right now they're being held back with some low-level infraction that they can't get jobs. They get stopped at the door whenever they try to apply for things to take care of their family. So this is an opportunity to help them further their lives and reach their full potential. And that's what we're here for, to help Alaskans. So I thank you for hearing this bill.
There's a question by Representative Allard.
Thank you, Representative Wright, for bringing this forward. So when you say low level, can you elaborate on that a little bit so that the public and myself can get a little bit more perspective on the low level and what it exactly is holding people back? I feel that there's more to it, and I'm going to pull it out of you.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, so when I say low level, I mean infractions that are legal today. All right, so and the thing that's holding them back, a lot of folks who apply for jobs, you know, there's things that show up on court view, and when they show up, it immediately stops the process for them. But I do have some folks online who can go into further detail.
May I just do one quick follow-up? So, for example, if it's personal use that is legal in Alaska, would that be something that would be holding folks back that could be expunged from the record, but perhaps stay on federally, but it'll allow them to get the jobs that they deserve and what that they need?
Absolutely. Okay. These folks are just looking to move on. You know, some things happened when they were younger, and now they're being marked for the rest of their lives. And this is just truly unfortunate to see something like that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is Vittorio Anastasi available online as the first invited testimony? Please state your name for the record.
Hi.
And continue with your testimony.
Hi, yes, this is Vittorio Anastasi. I'm the Director of Criminal Justice Policy at Reason Foundation. Can you all hear me all right?
Yes, please go ahead.
Sorry. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. There just simply isn't a compelling public safety interest in releasing the records affected by House Bill 28. Of course, these records would still be accessible to law enforcement. The question at hand is whether they should be released to the public upon request or in things like background checks for job applications. In fact, releasing low-level marijuana possession conviction records may actually undermine public safety by making it harder for people to stay on the right side of the law. For example, 90% of employers nationwide, according to surveys, conduct background checks on job applicants, and research suggests that job applicants who have a criminal conviction are approximately 50% less likely to receive a call back. And individuals with criminal records also face significant difficulty engaging in other productive activities, such as securing housing, obtaining occupational licenses, joining the military, gaining admission to universities, accessing financial services, and maintaining child custody. These are exactly the kinds of activities and behaviors that we want people who have prior criminal justice involvement to be engaged in. And the criminological research is fairly clear that things like getting employment and having ties to your community are very important factors in the process of ceasing criminal behavior. So House Bill 28 seeks to address this problem by prohibiting agencies from releasing criminal records related to cases where a defendant was convicted of possessing less than 1 ounce of marijuana, but only if the convicted individual requests that those records not be released. At the same time, the Alaska court system would be prohibited from posting records related to low-level possession convictions on publicly accessible websites. Again, that's the same quantity of less than 1 ounce, and that would not have to be requested by the person with the record And as mentioned, the court system has already undertaken the process of ceasing to post those records online. Compared to other states that have legalized marijuana, this is a relatively small step toward fixing the damage caused by prohibition. But nonetheless, these reforms would provide much needed relief to many Alaskans. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to the Reason Foundation. There are commercially available background checks, and I know that we could probably go back and expunge everything back to the beginning of time on our records. Is there anything that this does that would remove those records from those publicly accessible? Most of our pay sites have been verified. There's several of them that out there that you can do pretty extensive background checks. So does this do anything for those? And how far back are we going to expunge these records? And I know we're going to quit providing them, but what does this do to those public companies in terms of information?
Right. Yeah, so unfortunately, there's nothing in the bill that directly addresses private companies that have these databases existing, and that's something that's much more challenging to address than clearing what the courts keep on file or release through requests specifically to the court system. I could provide you with some additional information on ways that other states have tried to address that question, but it's not something that's handled in the legislation before you did that.
Follow up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think this is a question for the invited testimony. I'm specifically circling around to the compelling public interest argument, and I would like to know if there's a compelling public interest from an employer's perspective to know whether a candidate, an employment candidate, follows the law or not, as the employment is doing a risk assessment on hiring that candidate. So low-level marijuana conviction equals a law violation, a speeding ticket equals a law violation, and I want to know if there's a compelling public interest on whether that a risk assessment for propensity to follow the law or not is a in the public interest.
Right. So my comment was that there's not a compelling public safety interest. Whether or not employers have an interest in knowing this information is a slightly different question. I think what's important to keep in mind is that marijuana possession is now legal. So we're talking about conduct that was previously illegal and is now no longer considered a criminal offense. The question is whether that interest outweighs the other concerns associated with the collateral consequences of having a criminal record, right? And so I think for other types of offenses, that might be a more compelling interest on the part of the employer. But in the case of these relatively minor marijuana possession cases, I think there's more harm than good being done by these records being provided.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. So it's no surprise to anyone in the public. It's no surprise to anyone in the public that I myself have a criminal record. I have a lead foot. I have gotten a few speeding tickets in my lifetime. And yet here I am. I'm able to get employment, and I'm able to sit in elected office. And there's nothing stopping somebody that has a prior marijuana conviction from getting employed or from seeking elected office if they're presenting themselves to their employer or to the public to get elected in a manner that the public sees is valid. And I'm not sure how to phrase this as a question, Madam Chair. But the compelling public interest part of this is that if somebody is willing to violate the law, because everybody in the past decade knew that marijuana was illegal, they went ahead and did it anyway. And as an employer, I would like to know whether I'm hiring somebody that is capable of going ahead and doing it anyway, even if it's illegal. And that, in my mind, is a compelling public interest that I can make an assessment on through public data. Whether I'm hiring somebody to drive, which they may not want to hire me because I have speeding tickets, or whether I break the law in another manner, that's public information that the employer should have access to, and we are talking about removing that access from an employer's ability to make good decisions. So anyway, I'm sorry. I could not come up with a question.
You were great latitude. Do we, Representative Groh, is this a question for the invited testimony?
Yes, and for Representative Wright, both.
Okay.
So I must preface my comments by saying that although I have no openings in my office, I would seriously consider you as a candidate, Representative Carter, so the Congress just wants you to feel better. And I would also note that I would draw a distinction between a traffic offense and an actual criminal offense, as me, as an employer now. So, but more, I would also like to ask both the invited testifier and Representative Wright about actual experiences people have had. I believe Representative Wright and the invited witness may know of particular circumstances of individuals who've experienced this. Representative Wright has alluded to it, but maybe you could draw more fully some of the actual experiences that you know from real-life Alaskans or the invited testifier who apparently knows more about people around the country, what actual experiences that they have in terms of people trying to deal with this in the employment or housing context or other contexts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the Chair, Representative Groh, on my path to Juneau to become a legislator, I had to speak with a lot of individuals, and those individuals were, the majority of them said that they've had low-level convictions of marijuana, and they're being stopped at the door of organizations because there's a box they have to check. And when they check that box, all of a sudden, they are not the candidate. They can interview well, they can do all the things, and they never can get past that box. So that was an issue a lot of folks told me about. So these are just anecdotal stories, but you know, I came here with that on my mind, and I wanted to help the people that got me here, and I want to continue to help them. So if this is a barrier that is not illegal anymore, you know, I definitely want to see what we can do for them.
Vice Chair Allard. I think I'm going to direct this to Representative Wright through the chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling with this just a bit. And the reason why is because we're supposed to be held accountable for crimes that we commit. And in that, we have a debt to society. If the situation changes in our society, and here comes my question, and for example, there are other drugs that are made legal. I'm going to use heroin. And the person is charged with a felony, but it becomes legal. Do you think it's fair that we expunge all their records too, just because perhaps they can't get a job? And I would like to see how many people are literally not getting jobs just because they did that. But again, they do have a criminal record. They did commit that crime when it was illegal. And I don't know if it's so fair that we just expunge everybody's records. And then those who maybe had 3, 4, or 5 joints have a little bit of a higher crime. I don't know. Can you answer that?
Yeah, you know, through the chair.
Thank you.
Representative Allard, I'd like to say that, you know, once you pay your debt to society, it shouldn't be held over your head for the rest of your life, especially if now it's legal. You know, those are some of the things that, like I said before, hold people back. And, you know, these individuals, they don't have a lot of options when they're in this box. And then once they get in this box, they run the risk of staying in that lifestyle when they're being told they can't go anywhere else and this is all you have. So, you know, I just think that once you pay your debt to society, you shouldn't be marked for the rest of your life.
Follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Through the chair. But what about those individuals that are going to hire them? I have the same concern as Representative Carpenter, that as an employer, I am then being, I would say, lied to because it's expunged and I might not be able to have that information in front of me. And then I'm hiring someone that in the past has had poor judgment. How do you help an employer know that information? As both service members, prior service members, there's a standard and we're held to that. So could you help? How are we going to let employers know? We're just going to lie to them and say it never happened. And then I might not have hired that person based on poor judgment. And I think that's fair. Do you think the employer should know?
Yes, of course. But from what I understand after speaking with some employers, which I have, you know, I do my research, and a lot of them say that, hey, we really wish the box wasn't there, you know, because we got prime candidates. We need people. And right now, this is the time to hire as many folks as we possibly can because we don't have individuals to fill these spots. So a lot of these employers really would like to do away with the box, but for some reason they have it there because it's been something of a stigma towards having some criminal history when it comes to this, and they continue to keep it on there. It's the thing that they've been doing.
Follow up, Chair. Yeah, just one real quick one. My concern with it is, too, that this drug is still federally illegal. So I have a concern with that as well. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Wright.
May I? But we don't want to let, through the chair, we don't want to let a federal law dictate what we do in Alaska. We're Alaskans.
We do have another invited testifier who may address some of the questions as well. Follow up, Representative Allen.
I'll let it go. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the current public testimony online, you said you could maybe get some stuff the other states had done, and I'd like to see that just to see how we could expand beyond court view. And then I think that we've kind of discussed in here, and I don't know if there will not be a question here. There will be a statement I think we need to seriously look at. I think we can all agree this is a pretty serious policy decision that we're looking at making. I do not see how a court rule should be making serious policy. And so I think that we have a bigger picture here. I tend to agree with the intent of this legislation, but I think we have a much bigger picture here of the courts formulating policy on behalf of the legislature. So maybe there is a question in there.
So Representative Johnson, I too have thought of that and have some questions. After the full bill presentation, we can go through the specifics of this legislation. And also we have Ms. Nancy Mead, who represents speaks on behalf of the courts, who can discuss what the Alaska Supreme Court decision looks like as implemented and how the two speak to each other. But I would like to allow Representative Wright the opportunity to finish presenting the bill. And we do have Mr. David Morgan with the Reason Foundation as invited testimony. If you are available, you can begin your testimony. And if at all possible, address some of the concerns by members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, my name is David Morgan. I am a government affairs associate with Reason Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Approximately 7 years after legalization, many Alaskans are still saddled with criminal records for low-level marijuana possession. Alaska was an early leader in cannabis reform, but unfortunately now lags behind 24 other states that have already adopted reforms that facilitate the expungement or sealing of marijuana-related criminal convictions. It may sometimes be in the interest of public safety to track and provide information to the public about an individual's criminal background, but a one-size-fits-all approach to lifelong criminal records simply doesn't make sense. There is no evidence that individuals convicted of marijuana possession pose a credible threat to public safety. And marijuana possession is no longer illegal in Alaska. House Bill 28 is a long overdue step toward justice for Alaskans harmed by the war on drugs. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your consideration.
Do we have any questions? Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a current member of the military, if I smoked marijuana, I would be kicked out. Like, it's not allowed. I want to tell a little something, and then it will lead to a question. When I was working in California in an emergency department, a doctor came to me and said that his son wanted to join the military, and he was asking for advice. And he says, now my son is a pot smoker. And we got and I said, well, you can't do that in the military. He said, he understands that, but he wants to be honest on his application. And I had to give him the advice that he cannot be honest on his application or he will not be accepted into the military. Because if you do that, if you click that you have taken an illegal drug or taken a prescription that wasn't prescribed to you, you will not meet the moral standard of the U.S. military. You would not be able to be in the military because you wouldn't have the moral standing. We wouldn't want somebody who would join the military who would lie about something like this. But I will tell you, teenagers across the country have smoked marijuana, and I believe that they can make good soldiers. My question is, do we have evidence from the Reason Foundation where expunging these marijuana convictions has enabled people to join the military? Thank you.
Mr. Morgan.
I will defer to my colleague, Vittorio Nassassi. He has more of the research side of that in terms of that particular question.
Mr. Nassassi.
Thank you. So it's specifically to the question of joining the military, there's not really any research looking specifically at that question. However, there are several studies that have looked at the effects of having a criminal record on applications to either a job or to university admission, which is similar in the process. And those research findings indicate that if you have two identical job applications, identical experience, and one of the applicants has a criminal record and one of the applicants does not have a criminal record, the individual who has the record is 50% less likely to receive a callback. And so that's kind of the scale in terms of measuring how negative of an impact a criminal record has on somebody. Regardless of when the record was, or necessarily what the record is for.
Thank you, Mr. Nassassi. Representative Gray, while the legalization of marijuana in Alaska has changed, it is not under the federal government, and their standards as the U.S. military remain in effect. So regardless of what we change in the state of Alaska, they still have the authority to maintain their standards. Vice Chair Allard.
May I make a comment, Madam Chair? If not, that's fine. I can withhold it.
Let's continue with questions about the bill. We do have DPS available. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. So I don't know who wants to answer it. If we expunge the record and then the individual goes to apply to go into the armed forces, I think there's another level of investigation, so it would show up federally. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wright, do you have a further presentation for the members?
Through the chair, I do not at this time.
Okay. I think we still have a lot of questions about this, and we still have time. So I would like to pivot to the question of the impact of the court system. If we could take a brief at ease for a moment and invite Nancy Mead to the table. Thank you, Ms. Mead, for joining us. And the Alaska Supreme Court has made some recent decisions. Would you brief the members on this decision that looks awfully similar to this bill and how that is being implemented? Because as mentioned by Representative Johnson, we have a larger policy discussion, and I want to kind of compare what is going to be implemented by the courts, what that looks like, so that we can reflect on this piece of legislation before us.
To the chair, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I really appreciate the opportunity to explain the court's recent order. One thing I do want to say preliminarily, if it's acceptable, Madam Chair, is that this bill doesn't expunge anything, and it is not the elimination or the vacation or elimination of anything that happened in somebody's criminal history. So the bill does two completely different things. One has to do with the Department of Public Safety, sections 2 and 3, and what happens when somebody goes to DPS for a background check. That is the repository for official criminal records in the state of Alaska. They maintain the Public Safety Information Network database. That's where you go for a criminal records check. Sections 2 and 3, and I won't speak for DPS, but affects what they will release in just some of those criminal background checks, and I'll let them get more specific.
And before you begin, we do have Lisa Purinton with DPS in the room that we will pivot to that, but I wanted you to be able to get to the previous question that has come up.
Correct. So Section 4 is the only one of this bill, well, and 5, that touches the court system. And all this bill would do, and what the Supreme Court already has done, is say that certain records cannot appear on the public version of court view. I want to be clear, they're not made confidential. They aren't expunged. They aren't eliminated. If you want to see these records, you just go to the courthouse, where we have a more complete database available for people to look at. So the court has an administrative rule, because court view is just our case management system. It's just our website, that where the court has decided that certain cases should not appear on that public version of court view in recognition of the fact that people use it for all sorts of purposes. So the court amends its rules periodically. This is actually one of the most amended rules that I've seen, and I think it's been 8 times in the last 6 or 7 years that they've made a modification and taken an additional category of cases off of public court view. And again, they're all available. They're just not on public court view. For example, cases where somebody files for a protective order and the court says no right from the get-go, no protective order, those used to be on court view. They were a court case. They got a case number. It happened. But when the court found, nothing basically of merit in those cases, the concern was that the respondent suffered consequences from having a DV protective order case on court view when really there was a judge found nothing to it whatsoever. Those were all removed from court view. If somebody gets a suspended imposition of sentence where they have to go through certain requirements, they're charged with something, they agree to go through certain requirements, they fulfill them all, and the sentence is never imposed, those are no longer on court view. The legislature said that any criminal case that ends with a dismissal or acquittal, and remember that's a very large percentage of criminal cases, those aren't on court view. Again, all these are available at the courthouse in a separate kiosk. Every courthouse has a kiosk on the first floor where you can look at these. So this is an additional category that the Supreme Court recently decided should not appear on the public version of court view. And as of May 1, our technology department will be removing them. As I say, it's just something the court reviews all the time to decide whether the value of having them posted publicly and very, very easily available to people is worthwhile. So to address the concerns about employers, if you want to know about a person's, what we call these unpublished cases, they happened, they're not expunged, they're just not published easily for people to find. You can come down, you can go to the Juneau courthouse, you can go to the Anchorage courthouse and put in Nancy Mead and find out if I had one of these unpublished cases, as in a DV protective order against me, a dismissed criminal case, or now the marijuana conviction case from before 2015. So they're not expunged, they're available. It's just a matter of the ease with which they're available. The court is conscious that we're the only state, as far as I know, where the entire criminal, all cases in the court system are available to somebody at one convenient website at their house looking up somebody on court view. And that is helpful in many ways to many people, and they enjoy that ease of ability to see what's going on in the courts. At the same time, there are those who think that it is unfair that it is so readily. And again, these are available. They're not confidential. You can get them in paper. You can get them at the courthouse. So I just want to say that that is what the court constantly weighs. For its part, the court could decide not to have court view. This is, again, just our case management system. Originally, in the early 2000s when it began, the really narrative all over the country is the more online, the better. As time has gone on over the past 20 years, there have been some rubs to that policy, and people realizing that sometimes conclusions can be drawn from what's online that may not be appropriate. So that's why the court adopted an order. It was not an order like in a piece of litigation. Nobody sued about it or anything like that. This is in the normal course. The court amends its rules just like you amend statutes. They meet about once a month to see what rules need amending. They have a process. They have rules committees. They get recommendations from experts about the pluses and minuses of certain rule changes. And this is one that the court recently did in the normal course.
We have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a statute that directs what is by court view or your court management system? Or is that solely a court rule decision?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, it's our own website. It's our own case management system. As I say, we could eliminate it. There are a couple of things that the legislature has said about court view in the past, and this is new in the past few years. The first one might have been in 2015 when Rep. Wilson had the bill that said that a criminal case ending in a dismissal or acquittal should not appear on court view. And that is, it is not a court rule or anything like that. It's a statute saying that. And our rule happens to say we'll take off of court view anything in, you know, these 15 categories and anything that the statutes say are confidential or can't be on court view. So that's the mechanism by which the court follow that statute. And there's also there was a Senate bill that said minor consuming alcohol cases will not appear in court view. And that one was only prospective. It was SB 165 in about 2016. And thereafter, no minor consuming alcohol cases are on court view. And the court, correspondingly of its own accord, amended its rule to say, nor retroactively, because that wasn't in the statute. So there is a marriage.
Follow up, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I need to educate myself here. What court rule are we talking about that gives the court the authority to make the decision on what is or is not available on court view?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, one answer, Administrative Rule 40, which is the one that was just amended, lists, it says that the court, and this is the Supreme Court is the only one that can pass court rules, says the court system shall maintain a database of all its cases. So that's what tells trial courts to keep data. And it says, and the court system will publish online or make available to the public a subset of that whole database, and it will exclude the following cases, confidential cases, anything the legislature says, those DV cases I mentioned, and now these low-level marijuana convictions.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Aller.
Thank you. And mine are really just short, simple. So just for clarification, because this was really important to me, these records are not being expunged.
Through the chair to Representative Aller, you are absolutely correct. They are not being expunged.
That put me on a little bit more at ease. As far as, Madam Chair, through the chair, as far as the checkbox on employment applications, will that still be there? Is that a state law? Because if it is, I want to get a little educated too.
Through the chair to Representative Aller, there is not a state law that I'm aware of that says a person in applying for a state job, I know for a fact it's not, but the court system has to check a box or disclose something. Some may have that, I'm not certain what the executive branch says when it's hiring people. I will say, though, that at least what the Supreme Court just did in that order does not change your criminal history. It shouldn't change your answer. All it does is say it's not on the website. It still happened from the court's point of view. So if you were going to have to say, if the question, and it all depends on that question, sometimes, more often, from my understanding, it's, have you ever been convicted of a felony? This is a misdemeanor, by the way, so it wouldn't count. If it says of any criminal offense, well, whatever the court did doesn't change it. You were convicted of a criminal offense.
Madam Chair, may I just do a quick? Yeah, thank you. So if I own a cafe and someone comes in and applies for a position, I could ask them and not be violating anybody's rights.
Through the chair to Representative Aller, that's my understanding, but okay. I'm not exactly that type of lawyer.
Okay, and then my last question, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I'm okay. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Groh.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, I just want to clarify one thing that you'd said before. You talked about there's a substantial number, I think you said, of acquittals and dismissals. Isn't it correct that there are very, very much many more dismissals than are acquittals in criminal cases?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, that is absolutely true.
Representative Allard.
I do have a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So a little bit is, and this is a question, I'm concerned that I understand about domestic violence, I understand about protective orders, because it's the safety of victims. But if we are, as a court system, deciding something that I believe the legislature should decide, but the court system is taking it upon themselves to decide whose records get seen or not, do you think that's fair?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, this is something the legislature could have done, could do, has not yet done, but has discussed for many years, right? Ever since 2015. But the court has authority over what's on its website. Just like you have authority over what goes on BASIS, you know, the governor's office can put what he or she wants on the governor's office webpage. This is in the court's purview to decide what goes on the public version of Court View. They're very attuned to people complaining about what might be on there, what is on there, what isn't on there, and being responsive to those sorts of concerns when it comes to a piece of what the court does that touches the public is within their purview to decide.
Madam Chair, can I do a follow-up just as clarification, please?
Follow-up.
Thank you, and through the chair. So for clarification, if you, as the court system, decided we don't want a website at all, we don't want anybody to know of any criminal records or anything like that, you don't have to have that up, but do you have to have it where a person would have to go in person to check versus a website that's live? Is there a difference between the two, Ms. Mead?
Through the chair, Representative Ballard, if I understand your question, I do believe it's not going to happen, but I do believe the court system, the Supreme Court, could say we're not going to have a website. We like to have a website because we want transparency. We want people to know what's going on in the courthouse. And we've expanded everything on our website over the years, except for narrowing some of the cases that appear on the public version of Court View. So the first part of your question is, yes, I believe the court does have authority whether to have a website or not. The second part of your question was more of, could the court limit like the public's access to the courthouse? It's an extremely hypothetical thing. The court wants more people in the courthouses. They want to show off their operations and help people understand exactly what's going on, whether it's in a criminal trial, whether it's in, you know, any case. We have a very open door policy. That's this sort of democracy principle that the court adheres to.
Thank you.
And follow up?
Yes, thank you. So through the chair, here is my concern. For 2.5 years, we were locked down. And there were individuals and employers that could not access the courthouse. So there you have it, that certain individuals that would be able to do it online because of COVID couldn't come in. The courthouses were locked unless it was for very specific reasons. So I don't know if you have a take on that, or I just feel like the courts are making decisions that maybe be out of their scope.
Through the chair, to Representative Allard, I'm not positive how to allay that. I can answer any specific question. I can answer that during COVID, when people were not allowed into the lobby, which was not for a very long period, but when they weren't allowed into the lobby, we would respond to these requests over the phone or by email. Again, we want people to know what's going on. That's when we started streaming hearings and streaming trials and whatnot. So even during COVID, if you said, I am, you know, Nancy Mead applied for a job and I don't see anything on public court view, but can you look at your unpublished cases? We would have responded to that.
Just one more, please. Madam Chair. It's okay. I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mead, I'd like to pivot back to the merits of this bill before us in Section 4 and 5 that does directly affect the court system. And can you speak to, are there any differences between what the Supreme Court has just decided in their court rules versus what is being proposed in the legislation so that we can see any nuances between the two?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. As for Section 4, the first part of that up through line 14, no. Both this bill and what the court did removes from court view the conduct that was legalized by the voters 8 years ago. The person has to be over 21. We're leaving on cases if the person was younger than that. It has to be for less than an ounce, and they can't have any other convictions in that same case. So if they were convicted of an assault and possession of marijuana, that case is staying on court view, and that is true both of the court rule adoption and representative rights bill. Secondly, though, and this is a little bit of a nitpick, on page 3, starting at line 15, it says the court shall post a notice about how to get your real criminal history background check, because court view is not a background check. The court's been doing that for a couple of years. So that is I mean, I brought it. If you go to Courtview, search cases Courtview, the first thing you see is in red, notice, this is not your official criminal history records check. Go to Department of Public Safety for that. So the court didn't recently do that, but it did that before. So that is not, in my mind, something that that would need to be passed. It's already done. You know, for Section 4 and 5, we are removing these cases retroactively. So in terms of Section 5, it's already been done. I also want to say that there is a link on CourtView called Cases Removed from the Public Index, and you can click that and see what I'm talking about. All the cases that under the rule or statutes are removed are described for people, and we also have a form that you can click right there saying, my case is on CourtView, and I think I'm in one of the categories where I shouldn't be on there. And people submit that form, and we will do a specific check, because we aren't specifically checking. We're doing a more global technological way of addressing this. But if people think we're wrong, we will look again at their specific case and remove it if reasonable, if correct, if it fits the rule.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Mead? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, did the court order 2001 that we're discussing today go through the Rules Committee process to become changed?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, administrative rules don't have a Rules Committee. The Rules Committees are for the more substantive areas. There's a Criminal Rules Committee, Civil Rules, Appellate Rules, Child in Need of Aid Rules, Probate Rules. Administrative rules come to the attention of the court from the administrative office, from administrators. I'm one. Doug is one. The people who work in the administrative office and deal with like technology issues or, you know, the hours of the court, it's an administrative matter, and therefore they don't ever go through a committee process.
Follow up?
Is the authority to approve that rule change still at the Supreme Court?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, yes.
Thank you.
We have noticed, Ms. Mead, that our copy of the court rules in this committee room are quite aged. Are those court rules available online? And would you be able to provide us an updated edition of the court rules?
Through the chair, I have probably three in my office, so I will bring one here for your use. But yes, they are online. On the court's website, there's a bar across the top of links. You click rules, and then they're by, you know, administrative rules, criminal rules, civil rules, China rules, etc. And you can access them all there. And if anyone ever wonders or has an issue, I'm happy to try to help with that.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Mead? Thank you for coming and explaining the nuances specific to the legislation and the recent decision by the Supreme Court. We do have a few remaining minutes that I would like to invite Ms. Lisa Perrington from DPS to the table to answer a question. I apologize for putting you on the spot. We do have a fiscal note that I have a question in light of some of the recent decisions and how that is. Please state your name for the record, and then I can ask your question.
For the record, Lisa Perrington, the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief for the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you for being available. We have a fiscal note from DPS pertaining to this legislation, and how is DPS in their process for the criminal justice system and these records is being impacted by this piece of legislation? Is DPS in the same process affected by this court rule change?
To the chair, the court rule won't have an impact on the official, as Ms. Mead had referred to, the state's criminal history repository. The department maintains the state's criminal history repository, and the court rules would not have an impact on the information that would be maintained or disseminated from the repository.
Would you speak to this fiscal note and how removing this availability from the public in, as proposed in the legislation is going to have an increased cost to the department.
To the chair, the fiscal note that the department submitted is twofold. One of it is for programming costs to make the change in the repository to what we refer to as seal the record, so that the seal of the record means the record does not get removed from the repository, but it is limited in its release to the public as outlined in this bill, which is what we would call an any person report. So it doesn't limit it for all background checks. It just limits it to a specific type of background check that's outlined in Alaska Statute 1262-160B9, I believe it is in the bill, for the any person report. So the programming would need to limit it. So when a person goes to the Department of Public Safety and requests a copy of their background check for that specific reason, so that any convictions that would fall within the scope of this bill would not be displayed on that response that's given to the individual that requests the background check.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how does the court rule change affect the physical note? Would there be a physical note on the court rule change? Because you have to do the same thing, right?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, the court rule would have no impact on whether we release or don't release the information. The court rule, as I understand, has already been put in place, and according to Ms. Mead, they'll deploy that programming on May 1st. So that information would not be available from court view, but that information is still sitting in the repository, and if somebody were to come in and request a copy of their criminal history record, that conviction would still be disseminated, because there's not been a statutory change that would prohibit us from releasing the criminal conviction.
Follow up?
Whether the decision comes from the court or the legislature, there's still a cost. I mean, you've decided the same thing. So how do we, if this bill goes away, in next year's budget, are you going to ask for an increment for the court rule change of, I don't have the number in front of me. So would that be an increase in the budget, or would the courts absorb that, or where would that fall? The money's got to be accounted for someplace.
Absolutely. Through the chair to Representative Johnson, the court rule is limited to the information that's going to be available on the court's website for court view. The court rule change has zero impact on the state's criminal history repository. We are not changing anything in there, so we don't have to do any programming changes based on the court rule. By law, we are still going to disseminate the criminal history records that are in the repository, because there's no law that prevents disseminating a conviction for under an ounce of marijuana under 1171-060, we're still going to disseminate that unless this bill were to pass, and then it would restrict dissemination of those records. At that time when the bill would pass, we would have to do a one-time cost for programming changes so that we could, quote-unquote, seal the record so that it's not disseminated. It's still going to sit in the repository, and for other types of background checks, we would release it, because this law doesn't prohibit it for all background check types. And what I'm referencing is, if you wanted to be a foster care parent or a teacher, we would still release that conviction, because those are different authorizations under the law. I'm sorry, if I'm not understanding the question.
No, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm not understanding the answer. It seems to me like nothing will change in Department of Public Safety because of the court rule change.
Correct.
Then why is there a physical note?
The physical note is attached to the bill. If the bill is passed, then the statute does change, And then it does require public safety to then modify the state's criminal history repository to prevent the release of these specific convictions in certain background check requests. That's when we're going to need to have the physical note to pay for the programming change.
If I am correct, I believe that is Section 3 of the bill, if I have that, of where it says on line 27 on page 2, an agency may not release criminal justice information of a criminal case in which the defendant, and then it carries on. But we have sparked a whole litany of questions, and I'm going to let Representative Johnson finish his thought since we have run out of time, but we will have this bill back for us. Representative Johnson.
No, I'm going to yield. I think I need to think about this more. I'm not quite understanding how the math works.
Two different databases? One database in the court system and one database in the executive branch.
So we will have this bill before us and get a broader view of the impacts of each section. And I appreciate you being here before us to answer the questions on the spot, and also for Representative Wright bringing this bill before us today. We are going to set HB 28 aside. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Friday, March 3rd at 1 p.m. to take up amendments on HB 66. And after that, the committee will hear HB 67, having to do with harassment from the governor, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its first hearing. And again, a reminder for amendment deadline for HB 66 tomorrow at 5 p.m. in my office. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 3 p.m.